You'll be about a mile away from the prison. It'll be to the southwest of you at that point. Not sure what you'll be able to see from there. There should be some light cover till you're close to the freeway, but then it's flat, dirt fields from there on out. You'll have to cross two freeways to get to the prison itself if you're planning on going all the way there, Jim says, pointing out places on my map. Okay, I think the four of us should go. That'll keep our presence low, but still provide some firepower if we need. Robert, Greg, McCafferty, you're with me. Horace, you're in charge here. Keep a perimeter and stay out of sight, but be ready to support us if needed, I say. I'm taking McCafferty because if something does happen and we have to evade, she knows the area better than we do. Plus, it'll keep her busy and may ease her tension knowing she's doing something. Again, I can't imagine the stress that must be going on inside of her. I noticed the shocked look on Robert's face. Yes, you're going. We're only doing a recon, and you're sneaky as hell. The shocked look is replaced with a grin. I'm not sure how he can grin with the smell, but he manages. There's something else in his expression, but I can't quite tell what it is. Gratitude, perhaps? Maybe enjoying the recognition? I'm not sure. I have mixed emotions regarding this, but I've come to realize those won't ever fade. We're only going to have a look, and although I've worked with him and Bree, nothing replaces experience. I just hope he doesn't have to experience much more. This new world is wearing me out. The sun is still just past its overhead mark, but it won't be long before it wends its way further to the west. We have some time, but we also have a hike ahead of us, according to the map. The heat of the day and pervading smell makes the gully feel oppressive. The small amount of water drifting by slowly in the creek provides little cooling and makes it worse in some way. Perhaps it's because it's the brownish water prevalent in Texas and not the clear water of the Northwest that I'm used to. Whatever it is, I don't like it a whole lot. It's a little after 1300 now. We need to be out of here by 1700. That'll give us enough time to get back with some to spare. We won't have to stop for fuel, so that's a plus. That gives us 2 hours in and out. According to the map, it's about a mile to the bend, and we'll see what we can from there. Any questions? I ask. No one responds. Okay, get your gear, I tell Greg, Robert, and McCafferty. We're traveling light. Radios, ammo, and bring plenty of water. I'm not drinking anything from that, I add, pointing to the almost stagnant water. Especially with those cattle pens close by. No telling what's leaked in. We'll meet in 5. I've drunk out of worse places, but had plenty of iodine tablets. Well, maybe not worse. There weren't thousands of dead cows possibly leaking their goodness into it. We start out along the creek bottom. I'm leading with Greg behind, followed by Robert and McCafferty. There's not much we can do for the smell, and I'd like to say we get used to it, but I'd be lying. I look for something to put under my nose to help ease the stench, but come up empty. I make a mental note to keep Vicks handy for smells. It seems like I already made that mental note, but apparently it didn't take too well. I used to carry it with me always, so I'm surprised I didn't automatically pack it along. I guess not all things have come back as readily. The creek meanders some in the gully, and there are some trees along its meager banks, but not enough to keep us shaded from the sun and heat. The odor seems to get stronger the further down the gully we go, but that may just be my imagination. The banks are high enough to keep us from becoming outlined in any fashion from above, so we take care to keep quiet and proceed alertly. I'm pretty sure no one in their right mind would be close with the obnoxious smell in the vicinity. The warmth works on us as we work our way to the bend in the creek. I find myself stumbling over the occasional rock or two, but we keep it slow, so I manage to stay out of the creek. At the bend is the faint outline of a road and a ford. I wonder why we didn't travel here to begin with. Maybe our approach would have been seen from the prison. Jim seems like a pretty good guy and knows the area well, so that may have had something to do with it. Or he didn't want to get any closer. For whatever reason, we're here, and it's time to take a look. There's a faint path leading upward from the ford. It's mostly overgrown with knee-high bushes, but it's still distinguishable. As we climb, the sound of birds reaches us. The higher we get, the louder it gets. I hold the others back and crouch low as we near the crest. Reaching a position where I can barely see over the ledge, I scan the area. If anything, the atrocious odor hits even harder. Yes, I know I'm obsessing on the stench, but the overwhelming smell cannot be adequately described. I've smelled mass graves before. Those were rose gardens in comparison. The fencing surrounding the pens is close to the rim of the gully. Black humps lie on the ground as far as I can see back to the east, the direction we came from, and to the south. The size, at least what I can see from here, is immense. No wonder the air is so offensive. There must be thousands upon thousands of dead cattle. I can actually hear the drone of flies from my position. The earth within the separate cattle pens is actually a deep red from the literal tons of blood that have been spilled on the ground. Further east is something that just about empties my stomach. Large lakes, and I mean lakes, not ponds, are filled with red liquid. I cannot imagine what they used to look like before, as I'm sure evaporation has taken its toll, but they're filled with blood. Whoever built this gigantic slaughter yard sloped it in such a way that the blood would eventually flow to these lakes. It's not just one lake, but several that stretch back over a mile. This has to be the single most disgusting sight I've ever seen. It must seep underground to the creek below. I don't see how it couldn't unless they've lined it somehow, but seeing what I am, I sincerely doubt they did anything like that. I'm thinking the brown I noticed in the water isn't silt or dirt eroding. "Horace, Jack here," I call on the radio.
"Go ahead, sir,"
she responds. "Do not, I repeat, do not let anyone drink any of the water in the creek or wash with it. Don't even let anyone get wet," I say. "I'm not even going to tell you why. Just don't."
"Will do, sir,"
Horace replies. I look around the remaining area with the binoculars. There's not much to see as the pens continue another half mile ahead of us, intersecting a major freeway. The slight cover Jim mentioned getting close to the road does not even merit the word slight. It's almost non-existent. A few trees or copses of stunted trees spread over a field of brown adjacent to the pens. We can get to the highway via the fields, and we'll have to, as there is no way I see us going through those pens. The dead cows and stench aside, we'll disturb hundreds of birds, and their flight could alert others that something is prowling around. I can't see the prison from my position, which is probably a good thing. Other than hundreds of scavenging birds feasting in the yards, their cries filling the air, I don't observe any movement. I crawl back from the edge and wave the others up. You're about to see the worst sight ever. There's a cattle slaughter yard that stretches for over a mile to the east and a half mile to the west. Who knows how far south it stretches? No sign of any movement, and I can't see the prison from here. Let's edge up and pick the best route to get closer. Try to ignore the pens, as you won't like what you see there, I say. We crawl up to the edge of the gully.
"Fucking A," I hear Robert breathe. "That's just disgusting."
"I told you not to look," I say. Robert looks over with a weird expression. I realize he was whispering to himself, and I shouldn't have been able to hear it. I just give him a shrug and break out the map for us to study. There are two major freeways that come together in a Y on the other side of the yard.
The only buildings I see in the area are the cattle pen buildings near the highway to the west and some in the Y between the highways. I'm thinking the prison is sitting in a field on the other side where the roads meet, I say. Any ideas?
We could use the cattle pen buildings to mask our approach and see what we see from there. Maybe even go to the roof, but that'll mean going through some of those last cattle enclosures, Greg suggests.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that, I reply.
We could skirt the pens using the buildings to cover our approach and see how far we can get. At least we'd be closer,
Robert says. True enough. We're certainly not going to see anything from here. Stay low and quiet. We'll use the buildings and trees to mask our approach as much as we can. Keep an eye on the road and your ears open, I say. I'm still not all that keen on getting close to all of those dead cattle. I can't even imagine the diseases that must be prevalent. We head away from the gully, crouching and angling toward the slaughter yard, but mostly using the sparse cover of trees as best we can. The ground beneath our feet is more like baked clay rather than actual dirt, and radiates the heat of the day upward. The gagging stench follows us with every step. I breathe through my mouth to alleviate the smell, but it makes it seem like I can taste the thousands of dead cattle. I use the buildings as a shield against prying eyes that may be at the prison. The sparse trees end less than a quarter mile from the highway. From here, it's flat, bare ground. I still can't see the prison, but that was the plan for the approach anyway. I halt beside the last tree and listen. The others drop to their knees as well, covering our sides and rear. There's only the constant, faint buzz of the flies and the cry of birds. The area from our location to the rear of the buildings is only a small one, but it's in the open. If anyone happens by while we're traversing, we'll be easily seen. The only option if that happens is to drop down and hope we only look like a dark spot on the ground. From the looks of it, we're going to have to cross one of the pens to get to the buildings after all. The dead cattle seem to cover every inch of the ground, and the air above them is filled with clouds of flies. The birds are concentrated toward the middle of the slaughter yard, so traveling through any of the pens on the side won't create a disturbance. It's now that I wish I could fly like the birds, pecking away at the corpses, or at least hover. I wave Greg, Robert, and McCafferty forward.
We'll cross one at a time. I'll make for the fence. McCafferty, you're next. I'll call for you when I'm there and the coast is clear. Robert, you're third, and then Greg. If we hear anyone approaching, drop down and make like a black hole, I whisper.
The others nod their understanding.
I want Greg last, as I don't want Robert alone in case something happens. My priorities still remain the same.
See you on the other side.
I rise and rush across the open field, feeling very naked. There's no use trying to be slow or stealthy at this point. If anyone's watching, they'll see me regardless of how fast or slow I'm going, so the key is to keep my time in the open held to a minimum. I feel my boots striking the hard ground as I transit, keeping an eye out for any movement. Beads of sweat form from the additional exertion, and the hot air is hard to breathe. My stomach is still doing leaps from the sight and smell of the yard, and running isn't helping that at all.
I'm too old for this shit,
I think, drawing close to the wired fence enclosure. I notice a narrow strip of land situated between two pens that's free of the black lumps that used to be cattle. It leads directly to a small dirt lot behind the buildings. I alter my path, making directly for it. I'm thankful for the lack of any shouts of discovery or shots ringing out. That would really suck out in the open. It seems like it takes forever to reach the far side, but I'm there in about 2 minutes. 2 minutes in the open can seem like an eternity. I go to my knees next to a gate, breathing hard. I gag twice from the stench. The run across the field in the heat doesn't help this. Eventually, my stomach settles back to being only slightly nauseous.
My panting is loud, but I listen past it for any sounds that my transit was noticed. It's hard to hear over the perpetual buzzing that's louder now that I'm right next to the thousands of dead cows. I still can't see the prison from here, but look into the dusty lot behind the buildings that's filled with semis and cattle trailers. There are also hundreds of pallets littering the yard. The building itself appears to be a large headquarters or office building with an attached warehouse. I see some of the freeway that runs just in front of the buildings. It's all quiet, except for the birds and flies in the background, and there's nothing moving in the area. "Okay, McCafferty, it's clear," I say. I see a small dark shape rise from beside a tree and begin to dash across the open field. There's a shimmer from the heat waves masking McCafferty to an extent. It seems like she's running in place, and her dark shape doesn't grow any larger for the longest of times. She suddenly materializes halfway and grows larger by the second until she plops down beside me, panting. She gags for a second and then regains her composure.
"You know, sir,"
she says, catching her breath and talking between pants,
"I've lived here for what seems like forever, and never knew this place was this big."
"I'm not sure how anyone could live within 100 miles of this place. It smells now, but it must have smelled bad before as well," I reply before calling Robert over. The same scene is replayed twice again before Greg slides down beside the fence.
"I see your running skills haven't improved," he says, finally catching his breath.
"I see you still want to lock your teeth on my ass in a biting motion," I reply. The lack of additional sounds indicates our little adventure can continue. Let's make our way down this lane and through the yard to the far corner. "Single file and keep your spacing," I say. We rise and open the gate wide enough to pass through. The buzzing of the flies is annoying, much like mosquitoes buzzing in a tent, but we're nearing the prison and the irritant is put to the side. We skirt piles of pallets, some stacked and some just strewn, and make our way to the rear of the building near the corner. Feeling the heat radiate from the aluminum-sided building, I crouch and peek around the corner. The highway looms close, with additional buildings across the way nestled between the north-south freeway just in front and another that branches off heading west. Between some of the buildings, I catch the first sight of the prison walls in the distance. Yep, they're prison walls, tall and concrete. A wide field devoid of any obstructions surrounds it. I take a look through the binoculars, shielding the lens with my hands to prevent any glare reaching out as the sun is in front of me. Heat waves shimmer in the distance, obscuring a clear look at the prison. I also glass the buildings across the freeway, but I don't see anything more out of the ordinary than usual. Nothing is normal these days. There is one thing across the road that does catch my attention, and I wave Greg over.
Nice. A water tower. That's rather handy," he says, following my finger. "Now if we can just get there and climb it without being seen."
"Now that would be the ideal result. I figure the heat waves should keep us partially hidden," I respond. "There's only one thing really keeping us from gaining an advantage of height to observe, and that's the open road in front of us. If the ones in the prison are keeping an outpost, the buildings across from us would be ideal for that. There's also the fact that part of our route across the highway may be visible from the prison itself. I'm hoping the shimmers will help keep us hidden. The water tower is only about a half mile from the walls, and once we begin climbing the tower, we'll be in the open once again. The ladder leading upward to the catwalk lining the top runs up one of the outside support posts and is in the open. Luckily, it's on the back side of the tower away from the prison. Okay, same as before. We'll cross one at a time in the same order. Greg, if I'm spotted or rounds start getting exchanged, get out of here. Start heading back with Robert and McCafferty and have Horace meet you. We're not in a position to duke it out with 20 or 30 others, I say. I'll meet you when I can.
You got it, he replies. Okay. Here goes nothing. I edged to the very front of the building. Two sets of railway tracks are directly in front, with a wide dirt median separating them from the two-lane highway. It's not quite as far as the wide field we came through, but it's a sprint. I'm hesitant about crossing. It's daylight, and I imagine the ones in the prison could be out scavenging. Being this close, there's an increased chance of having them coming or going while we're in the open. It's not a comfortable feeling. And that's aside from them keeping an outpost. I don't see any cars in front of the buildings, but that doesn't really mean anything. I take one more look at the buildings, searching for any sign that they're being inhabited in any way. Grime covers the glass windows in front. There aren't any smear marks of someone trying to wipe them clean, so that's an added bonus. I look up and down the highway to the north and south. I don't see anything, but the shimmers could hide vehicles in the distance. It's now or never, I breathe to myself. With a deep, stabilizing breath, I rise and begin another rush across open ground. I quickly gain the first set of railroad tracks and cross with the gravel crunching under my boots. I notice the tops of the tracks are still shiny from a lot of use, but that'll change when the rains come. Looking as I cross, they stretch in a straight line to both sides and merge in the distance, eventually vanishing in a haze. The gravel gives way to packed earth as I make my way to the hardtop road. I keep expecting winks of light to materialize from the buildings ahead, but they remain as before, seemingly empty and quiet. The heat radiating from the ground increases as I step onto the concrete of the highway. My boots clump on the road that once carried a stream of cars and semis. Now, I'm the only one to intrude upon its surface. I'm across quickly and duck inside a driveway entrance between two sides of a fence. I fall to my knees again, panting from the exertion and the heat. The buzzing of the flies is only faint now, and the intense smell dissipates to a degree. Either that or I become used to it. And that's not something I want to become used to. The tower looms ahead. It looks like we'll have to clear another yard behind the building in front of me, and then we're there. I call clear, and the others cross one at a time without incident. It already seems like hours since we left. I check my watch. We have 40 minutes until we have to head back, so we'll have to make this quick, I say, and report back to Horace on our progress. I feel the strain of being close but not sure of the outcome. It surely can't be compared to the tension McCafferty must be feeling. I feel both loose and tight at the same time. Tension with an underlying calmness. We'll have to go slow, especially being so close to a major intersection. On the other hand, we don't have a lot of time to spare. The warmth is taking its toll as well. In black fatigues and vest, I feel my energy being sapped by the minute. I know this is the place where mistakes can be made, and I try to keep my mind sharp. Taking a drink of water, I rise and head across the dirt parking lot to the building's corner. The large lot is filled with mounds of scrap metal. Mobile cranes with large magnets attached dot the yard. Wrecked cars line one entire side. Now, this place would be quite handy if we had a smelter. I don't have time to ponder the possibilities as we need to get to the tower undiscovered, climb it, and see if we can see over the prison walls less than half a mile away. Hopefully, all of that will keep me within the undiscovered realm as well. We move from pile to pile, advancing into the yard itself. The piles keep us hidden from views of the road on either side. We eventually come to the end of the mounds of scrap. Ahead is another building with the water tower sitting close to its side. A larger freeway lies on the other side of the building. We advance slowly to the base of the water tower. I pick up the sound of a car motoring down the road approaching from our right. The whirring of the tires on the hot pavement mixes with the low hum of the engine. "Car approaching, take cover," I say into my throat mic.
There's a scramble as we dart behind the building nearest the highway. The sound of the vehicle increases, but I don't see anything on the road as I peek around the corner of the building. I hope it isn't bouncing off the large aluminum buildings and actually approaching from behind or side. I look around and see a couple of thick bushes against a fence to our rear. I point, and we dash across, burrowing in their midst. I lie on the ground at the very edge of the bushes, and am able to see a section of the highway. There's still no sign of any car, but I can still hear it grow louder. Greg gives me a little tilt of his head. I hold my finger to my lips, and he gets the message. Lying on the ground increases the heat radiating to my body, and I feel grit inside my fatigue top. My belt line itches from the heat and dirt, and the limbs of the bushes are prickling my skin where they touch. All in all, I'm not comfortable. The heat is even masking the adrenaline, so I'm ready to be done with this and go home. The sound gets louder, and I see Greg nod, indicating he can hear it now as well. Robert or McCafferty are out of my sight, as they're burrowed in an adjacent bush. The noise changes to the sounds of the car slowing down. I pick out sounds of other engines. There's more than one, and possibly three. The slowing down isn't a good sign. Either we've been seen and a call went out, or they're slowing to make a turn. The only right answer is for them to make a turn away from us toward the prison. Any turn toward us, or if we've been spotted, is bad news. A white pickup truck comes into view, going slow on the section of road I can see. Another green pickup is right on its tail. Both of the beds appear to have boxes and miscellaneous gear stacked in them. Both trucks vanish in front of the building, and they sound like they're slowing even more. I wait for the crunch of the tires hitting the gravel and dirt parking lot in front of the building. A third truck comes into view and disappears. The sounds from in front increase as the trucks begin picking up speed. They fade slowly until disappearing altogether. I realize I've been holding my breath and let it out slowly. I feel grimy from the sweat, dirt, and still pervasive smell. A long, cold shower sounds so good that I almost wish for the storms to come back. We wait a few minutes longer to see if the trucks come back our way. If they are heading to the prison, they could just be dropping stuff off and return heading on another supply run. We just don't have time to wait, though. I don't want to put us at risk, but if we're going to have a look, we have to do it soon. There are only the faint caws, cackles, and screeches of the distant birds. Robert, McCafferty, keep watch from the rear of the building. If anything happens, radio Horace and get yourselves back. Greg, you're with me. We're out of time. Let's climb this monstrosity and get an eyeful, I say into the radio. We scoot out of the cover and dust ourselves off quickly. I feel a twig go down the back of my shirt. It's just one more annoyance that's forgotten quickly as we run across the small back lot to the side of the building again. I'll go first. Follow when I'm halfway up, I say, shouldering my M4. I hope you climb better than you run, he responds. I'm feeling a little gassy. I hope you enjoy your climb, I reply, and take off for the ladder rungs. I set my feet on the first rungs and reach up. The heated metal instantly sears through my gloves. It's like holding a boiling pot of water with a dish towel. It doesn't melt my skin directly to the rungs, but it still feels like my hands are going to catch on fire. It looks like I'll be scurrying up as it's hard to hold onto any one rung for long. I start my climb. Thoughts of being seen vanish as I make my way up. I just concentrate on each rung and climb as swiftly as I can. Each time I put my hand on a rung, it seems hotter than before. It's actually a race to see if I can make it to the top before my hands blister and start smoking. I try to set my boots on the rungs lightly. I don't want any ringing if there's someone in the area. I finally emerge through a hole in the grating of the catwalk and Neil just around the side of the tank, keeping it between the prison and me. Greg's head eventually pokes through. "Oh, that was fun," I say, still trying to fan the heat off my hands.
"Yeah, you got that right. You're quite the little monkey," he replies.
"I noticed you weren't exactly taking your time either," I say.
"No, that I wasn't," he says, chuckling.
If I'd known they made that ladder out of molten lava, I would have chosen differently, I state. Not wanting to have any more contact with the metal, but having to, we both lie on the heated catwalk grating and edge forward until the prison comes fully into view. We're higher than the walls and can readily see inside. From this height and angle, the heat shimmers aren't nearly as bad. The complex is huge. One extremely large single-story central building sits in the middle of the compound, with two buildings on either side of it. The side buildings are made up of three six-sided sections connected to each other in line with four thin rectangular wings jetting out from the end of each one. Those two buildings look to be three or four stories tall and connect to the main building via an enclosed pathway at ground level. Another very large building is connected to the main one as well. There are several HVAC units at ground level and van-like trucks parked at a loading bay attached to the second building. The pickup trucks we observed earlier are parked next to the cargo trucks with several other vehicles. The interesting thing is the lack of towers and parapets along the perimeter. The wall is certainly tall, but the place seems self-contained. There doesn't even appear to be places for the inmates to be outside. All in all, the place is huge. Not as large as the Madigan complex, but it's daunting to look at. There's no way we can assault this place with the teams we have, and perhaps not with all of our teams. I draw a quick diagram and make notes as we observe. We don't have time for an extended recon to note patrols, times, listen to frequencies, or observe any patterns. We have just a few scant minutes before we have to head back. Another walled complex sits to the south of the main prison. There are nine red-roofed buildings that lie within that place. The roofs look like they're corrugated and may even be made of sheet metal. Those buildings do not give the appearance of being able to house prisoners, but maybe it's a less secure one. "Well, it looks like it's either a small force entry or none at all," I say, still glancing through a set of binoculars. Greg's looking through a set of his own.
"That's what I think," he says. "It's getting over that wall that's going to be the hard part. At least there aren't any towers, and it doesn't look like those walls can be manned. Even if I had a grappling hook and it could latch on, I can't throw one 40 feet high, can you?"
Yeah, not so much," I say. "There is another way in, though."
"Are you thinking what I'm thinking?" Greg asks.
"I don't know. Mine involves silk," I answer.
Then we are thinking the same thing.
"Are you trained in Halo? High altitude, low opening jumps?" I ask.
"I went through the freefall school at Bragg, but haven't done it in a long time."
He lowers his binoculars and looks at me. "That's all right. I haven't jumped in a while either," I reply with a smile. "It'll be a hoot, but we have to figure out what to do after we come crashing out of the skies into the yard. Or roof."
"And where will we get the equipment? Bragg's a long way away from here and most likely in a radiation zone," Greg asks.
They used to teach the PJs, pararescue jumpers, out of Kirtland. I bet there's still some equipment housed there," I answer.
"And the chutes were packed when?"
Greg asks with a look on his face, asking if I'm serious about this.
Probably in the 70s, I answer. "You're kidding, right?"
"I hope so," I respond with a chuckle. Greg's face doesn't indicate he's getting warm, fuzzy feelings about this. "Actually, there used to be PJs who were stationed there to help train us," I add before his face falls too much further.
"And that was when?"
he asks, not at all convinced. "In the 70s. The look on his face makes it difficult to keep a straight face and keep quiet. Just kidding, man. Well, it's the only way I see in, so we can take a look and see if there's any equipment there. And yes, check the tags, I add. If there isn't any, then it certainly doesn't look good for getting in. Even if we were to get some heavy artillery, we can't go bashing our way in. We'd make it worse for those inside.
Yeah, I really don't see another way. I really don't see a way in, even if we manage to get past the walls, unless we set down, and I use that term loosely, on the roof and go through an access hatch. That structure on top may even house a maintenance door, Greg comments.
You know, some prisons have underground passageways for maintenance crews to circumvent portions of the buildings and areas that house prisoners, and for guards to move about. I bet this one does as well.
That compound to the south looks interesting, I say, and abandoned.
I don't see any vehicles around it. You could be right.
I wonder if there's a tunnel between the two facilities.
Maybe, but we only get one chance at this. And if there isn't, we're pretty screwed for getting in.
Yeah, that's true. So it's the main compound, then, I say, making some final notes.
I think so. If we can find some equipment, and if the chutes were packed recently.
Greg takes another look at the compound. Yeah, if on both accounts. I'm not too keen on finding out how high I can bounce.
Well, you may not bounce, you know. You may just crash through the roof, opening a hole for me to float gently through and rescue everyone, he says with a chuckle, stowing his gear.
I'm glad to know if I collide with the roof at high speed that it may benefit you. You be sure and tell me if there are any more things I can help you with.
You'll be the first to know.
And we'll have to plan on how to get out of there if things don't go well, but we can do that back at base. Right now, it's time to get out of here, I say.
Lead on.
An angel's wings unfurl.
Michael wakes in his darkened lair, ready for another night's hunt. He thinks again that he may have to move, as the food supplies have been scarce and harder to find. Sensing other packs in the area awaken, Michael represses the urge to call them together. He's still sorting through these new images, and doesn't feel the time is right. The lair has a chill to it that's been getting more so with the passing of the nights. The passage of the days when he has rested has been fine, but he knows he will have to find a warmer place soon, or find a way to keep warmer. His pack members provide warmth by huddling, and he knows he may have to call the others together before he is ready. The survival of the packs is paramount. Michael walks out into the familiar store proper, heading towards the broken glass door and the night. The hunt and sating his hunger await. He notes, as he lopes down an aisle, that some of the objects on the shelves have fallen to the ground. He mistimes one of his steps, and his foot comes down on a bag lying on the floor. The bag crunches under his step, and with a small popping sound, objects are thrown from it. He continues on toward the night's hunt. A few steps later, a scent reaches his nose. It's a new smell and not altogether unpleasant. It's not like the musty scent of prey, but has a sweeter odor. Stopping, he looks back at the broken bag and the contents that are scattered on the floor. He walks back sniffing at the air. Kneeling, Michael picks up one of the objects and brings it to his nose. There is some familiarity associated with the small object he's holding in his hand, something that he feels he should remember, but it hangs on the edge of understanding. He knows he should recall what this thing is, but the more he thinks about it, the farther away the understanding retreats. Bringing the object to his mouth, he licks it. The sensation on his tongue is startling, and he recoils slightly at the taste. It tastes so different than the food he has hunted every night. There is not the sweetness of biting into flesh, or the taste of blood, or, of course, the actual thrill of the hunt. He licks at the object again, this time not recoiling as much. Taking a small bite, the crunch feels like the crunch of bone, but not as hard. He chews another small piece. The crunch and salty taste are both familiar and unfamiliar. Michael puts the whole object in his mouth and bites down. It's not as tasty as prey, but it's not that bad. He grabs more and begins eating. Finishing the one scattered on the floor, he looks around for more. He picks up the bag, and more spill out. He eats those before finally pouring the entire contents on the floor and devouring them. Looking to the shelves, there are more of the same packages he stepped on, along with different-looking ones. Michael grabs a bag and sniffs it. It doesn't have the same odor. As a matter of fact, he can't smell anything coming from it. He drops it on the ground and slams his foot down on it. The same crunching and pop occur, spilling more objects on the ground. The same sweet aroma spills out with them. He eats the contents of the bag as before, noticing that his hunger abates, but is not entirely sated. The shelves around him are a little empty, but there is a smattering of the bags. He now knows these contain food of some sort. Again, it's not like the thrill of the hunt, but it is food. Walking down more aisles within the darkened store, he notices other objects on the shelves. They may also contain food, he thinks, picking up a round, metallic object. There isn't any smell from this, and it's harder than the other objects, but he drops it on the ground like the bag. It hits the floor with a thud. He brings his foot down hard on the object and howls with the sharp pain. Picking the object up, he sees that it is still whole. He slams the object on the ground. Looking again, Michael notices it's dented but not broken. He throws it down again, and again. The object breaks open slightly, spilling a small amount of liquid on the ground. A more appealing scent rises, and he bends down to sniff the little pool. It's still not like prey, or as sweet. It has more of a sour smell, but it is closer to the odor of prey than the objects in the bag. He licks at the liquid, and is pleasantly surprised by the taste. It evokes a deeper hunger, and he knows that this will sate his appetite more. He picks up the metallic object and walks over to one of the outside concrete walls. Throwing the can against the wall, it finally breaks open, spilling its contents against the wall and onto the floor. Chunks of something are in the liquid. He cautiously picks up one of the chunks and sniffs at it before putting it in his mouth. This is tastier than the other food. It's still not quite like prey, but he knows he has found more food. He spends the night going through the shelves, breaking one object after another. Some of the objects have very offensive odors, and he knows instinctively that they are not food. One of the larger objects, not as hard as the metallic one, but more so than the bag, breaks open. The scent that emanates from the liquid that spills out has a sharp odor that actually causes pain to his nose when he sniffs at it and causes his eyes to water. The night passes with Michael testing object after object. He has found another food source in case the nightly hunt comes up empty. He opens himself to the others to send the images of the objects on the shelves and associates it with food. Feeling sated and contented, he shuts himself off again and walks back to his lair to rest the day away.
Greg and I climb back down, meeting up with Robert and McCafferty. I quickly relay the information we found. Our time is short, so I can only give a brief synopsis.
"Do you think we can get in, sir?"
McCafferty asks anxiously. "I think we have a plan, but we need to get back. We'll also have to fly back to Kirtland to see if we can find some equipment. If we can get in to see about your parents, we will," I answer, patting her on the shoulder. McCafferty nods in understanding.
"I'm not sure Lynn would like your definition of a plan, Jack," Greg comments.
"Yeah, most likely not. Okay, let's call it more of an idea," I say. We make our way back in the same fashion as our arrival, with the sun lowering in the sky. The heat becomes even more oppressive as we draw near Horace's position. I radio our progress, letting her know when we're near so we're not shot coming in. Meeting up with the others, I give the same synopsis, promising to brief more when we arrive at the aircraft. We mount up and crawl our way back the way we came. The trip is still conducted slowly, as we don't want to draw attention to ourselves. If the group in the prison knows others are about, especially armed ones, they may beef up their defenses. Following the reverse of our route, we make it back to the freeway, heading back to Cannon AFB. At the town we had to battle our way around, I stop at the fringe of where we can visually see it. I do not really want a repeat episode, so we take a large detour through the fields. The day is moving on with the sun settling more into the west. If we had more time, I would venture around slowly so as not to kick up a line of dust, but time is one thing that's not really afforded to us right now. We move off the road and sweep further to the south than our previous route. I have Greg and Horace take stations to the side and behind, hidden from the distant town in our dust. Denton replaces Henderson on the top gun, and he keeps an eye around us, concentrating on the town, but he reports the area clear. We hook up with the highway again on the far side and make our way to Cannon AFB. The sun is just above the horizon when we drive onto the ramp. We're sweaty, dirty, and exhausted. This day seems like three, and it's good to be back. I would love a shower, but we'll have to settle for using the rest of the day to eat and take turns sponge bathing in the aircraft. Miguel arrives with another group shortly after, and I let him know what we're planning. "We won't be leaving for a few more days," I tell him.
"Whenever you're ready. We've lasted this long. I expect we can last a few days longer,"
Miguel says in response.
"I'm not a fan of gangs muscling others around. I could gather up a few of my amigos and help."
"I don't really think additional numbers are the answer, but thanks. If I thought we could take the place with numbers, I'd fly back and pick up the other teams," I reply. We spend the rest of what is left of the day eating and taking said sponge baths. Wiping the grime from the day is refreshing, but it isn't a total cleaning. I was once used to going days without showers, but I was also younger then. It's kind of like camping. Sleeping on the ground is no problem when you're young, but nothing beats an air mattress when you get older. I would often contemplate taking a small air mattress on missions, but I didn't want the added weight. A few pounds after hours and days of humping matters. The horizon covers half of the sun in a gorgeous sunset of reds, oranges, and purples, and then, after loitering for a moment, it sinks quickly below as if dropped. Miguel and his group leave, and we button up for the night.
She rises from her slumber, warm and content, yet eager for the nightly hunt. Looking at the others huddled together, she feels pleased with her pack and their ability to find food in the area. It's been getting scarcer, but with their increased pack size, they've been able to track down enough to sate them each night. She rubs her belly as if touching her young one growing within. She isn't showing yet, but neither are the other females in her pack. Soon, she will, and so will they. Soon she will not be able to run with the hunt, and will need the others to bring her food for a short time. Until then, though, she will enjoy the thrill. Several males, which are huddled around her, stir with the coming of the night. The former pack leaders vie for her attention and the position closest to her during their sleep. She hasn't allowed any one of them to catch her attention, as she has the pack and her young one to think of. She doesn't want them fighting amongst themselves either, and has been able to keep that in check so far. She rises and heads down to the lower level and outside to empty her night's waste. She's made each of them empty outside rather than pollute their comfortable lair. The night is clear, but with a chill in the air. Colder times are coming, but she feels their lair will keep them warm and dry. She sniffs the air, searching for the scent of food. There are a few hints of prey in the area, and she waits until the others join her outside. She then leads them on one of the trails leading into the woods nearby. Finding some food within the wooded expanse, she follows other scents to where the two-legged ones once lived. The hard ground under her feet is not as soft as within the trails of the forest, but she only notices it as an afterthought, and she's picked up a strong scent. She stops suddenly. Images fill her mind, sent by one as strong or stronger than her. She knows the sender is a distance away, but she has not felt anything like it before. The other one that tickled her mind many nights ago is still fresh. But that one was different. That one was one of the two-legged ones. And this one is one of her own kind. The images are of food and the strange objects found in some of the dark buildings. She feels drawn to the one sending the images. Not drawn in the same way as to the two-legged one. For that one, she feels an intrigue she can't shake. No, this pull is because this one is as aware, if not more so, than she is. She knows his exact location, but also knows he is distant. The others in her pack halt in response to her confusion, wondering why she stopped. They can sense the other's awareness and images as well, but they are on the hunt and are not nearly as intrigued as she. They do note the images of food being presented, but aren't sure how to proceed. They turn to her. The awareness of the other vanishes. She shakes her head and directs them back to the hunt. She will check out this new food another night. She will also ponder this other strong one. After the hunt, she will think about it.
The teams gather around as best as possible in the confined cargo compartment. We've sealed up the windows to prevent any light leaking out and have the interior cargo lights on. It's more like a locker room inside, but it's far better smelling than what we had earlier today. I give a more detailed description of what we saw and observe McCafferty's face fall with each item both Greg and I mention. If there were only five or so inside, we would have more of a chance. But with the possibility of 20 or more, our force would be eliminated pretty quickly if we were found out. Not only are there walls, although they're not manned, but there's the building itself. It's fortified as well, and would be difficult to get into with a force. Explosives to create an entrance in either the wall or building would possibly put the others inside in a worse situation.
So it's a no-go,
Gonzalez says, putting her arm around McCafferty. No, I didn't say that. Greg and I think we can jump in, I say. The silence in the aircraft is complete. Is there anyone else here who's Halo-trained? I ask moments later, breaking the silence. The quiet continues with a few shaking of heads. All righty then. I guess it's just Greg and me, I say.
We'll rest up tonight, and... The rest of my sentence is interrupted by the first of the Night Runner shrieks outside, followed by a ringing thump as one throws itself into the 130. More shrieks follow.
I guess our Night Runner guests have arrived,
Horace says. I sure miss conversations that don't have the word Night Runner in them, I say. Okay, we'll rest up as best we can, and then head over to Kirtland tomorrow to try and find some gear. Hopefully there will be some around that's legit, I add, as more solid thumps sound inside. I sure don't miss being inside an aircraft night after night with that noise ringing throughout the evening. I wonder just how much of that the 130 can actually take.
What do you want us to do?
Horace asks. Well, I figure we'll spend most of tomorrow, bang, looking for equipment, then set up, bang, for the drop. If there's enough time, we can, bang, get some rest. Greg and I will drop, bang. Fuck, that's annoying. Greg and I will drop that night. Robert and Craig will fly us. Bang. God damn it, shut the fuck up. Horace, take the rest of our teams down the following morning. Head down to the same place by the creek and wait for our radio call. If we don't call by noon, come back here and head home. I finish amongst continued slams and shrieks outside.
We'll be there, sir,
Horace responds.
How are you going to get out?
Robert asks. Hopefully via the front or rear gate, I answer. We'll have to commandeer vehicles depending on how many are inside.
And if you can't get to anyone and have to leave?
He asks. I'm assuming the gates can be opened from the inside. If we can't get inside, or if we find we can't help them, then we'll use the gate, but be a little sneakier. We'll have to wait until daybreak, though, so that'll be riskier. I can't even imagine how many night runners are out around a town of that size, I answer. Robert nods, but I can tell he isn't very happy with the response. I have my back to the ramp, and the others are standing in a semicircle in the back of the cargo compartment, facing me and the ramp, listening to the plan. Okay, it's an idea, but I'm thinking of it more as a plan at this point. Greg leans over and whispers in my ear,
Jack, can we talk about this privately?
I nod, and we head to the cockpit after letting the others know we'll be right back.
Bree listens to the conversation with Robert standing at her side. An icy feeling of fear strikes her gut as she listens to the plan, which includes her dad parachuting into a hostile compound at night. He can't be serious, can he? She asks, leaning over and talking quietly to Robert.
I think he is, Robert answers.
I don't like it. I mean, Dad parachuting in at night, and then the two of them facing all those people by themselves,
Bree says.
I don't either, Bree, but you know Dad, once he gets an idea...
Robert lets his sentence trail off.
Can he do it? I mean... Has he ever parachuted? And at night?
I don't know. I know some of Dad's stories, and I'm beginning to think there's a lot more to them,
Robert replies. But I'm not overly fond of him doing this. She feels her balance shift from the tempered steel inside to a feeling of fear, which turns into an anger boiling in her gut. That fear is redirected at the Night Runners. She realizes it is people her dad is going after, but she blames the Night Runners and feels they are indirectly responsible. If it weren't for the Night Runners, then they wouldn't be in this situation to begin with. The crowd of soldiers and the others they picked up the other day are intent on their own conversation. She backs slowly away. Bree's thoughts migrate back to her sister. A terrible longing envelops her. She misses Nick so much. Nick was always a source of comfort and inspiration to her. She misses the smile Nick always had for her. Misses Nick's enthusiasm for everything she did. She feels like a piece of her was ripped out when Nick died. The Night Runners took Nick away, just as they almost took her dad. They also changed her dad, both physically and emotionally. She doesn't recognize this part of her dad. He used to be playful and funny, and she misses that. She misses the laughter they shared. Now, he seems tired and too businesslike. She sees glimpses of the old dad from time to time, and relishes those moments, but now, with him contemplating doing something so dangerous without her really understanding why he has to, a deep fear of losing him surfaces. The slams against the aircraft and howls from the night runners continue, igniting a deeper hatred for them. She is tired, so emotions bubble to the surface easier. She watches as Greg and her dad head into the cockpit for some reason. The others mill about in the back of the aircraft. A slam pounds against the fuselage nearby, startling her. Bree feels a knot form in her stomach, and her teeth clench in frustration and anger. She's tired of this, and just wants things to go back to the way they were. The frustration of knowing it will never be that way again adds to already pent-up feelings. She looks behind her, noticing the ladder in place, leading to the overhead hatch. Looking back at the group, no one is paying any attention to her. The emotion she had on the firing range returns, with one notable exception. There is cold calculation involved. The feeling of wanting to see every night runner dead resurfaces. A part of her feels numb, but she remembers Gonzalez's words to her that day. She battles her emotions and feels a fear filling her, knowing what she's about to do. She's tired of reacting and wants to act. Determination sets in. Donning a set of NVGs and with her ever-present M4 shouldered, she begins to climb the ladder, fearful of being caught and even more fearful of what waits outside. She knows from watching the night runners that they can't scale the aircraft, so the top should be safe enough. Bree doesn't feel she's putting the others at risk by opening the top hatch, but she will close it when she's outside. There isn't any cry of alarm or shout of discovery as she reaches for the hatch opening. She opens it, and the shrieks outside increase only slightly. The night runners are below, so the increase doesn't reach the opening. She climbs out onto the top of the aircraft and gently closes the hatch. Lowering her NVGs, she looks across the area. The wings stretch flat away from her, with the four engines and huge props attached. The large tail rears into the night, and she looks forward to where the flat surface of the top arcs down to the cockpit, where her dad and Greg stand. Bright stars twinkle overhead against the black velvet sky, but are unseen in the green glow of her goggles. The chill of the night envelops her and sends a shiver down her spine. The chill is even more noticeable because of the heat that was prevalent during the day. Mindful of not stepping on anything important and following the pathways marked safe for walking, she edges to where the wing merges with the fuselage. On top, the screams of the night runners are more succinct and louder. She may not be able to kill all of the night runners, but she can take care of these around the aircraft. She becomes suddenly mindful of what she's doing and where she's at. She is outside with the night runners. Bree turns to head back. A renewed fear surfaces in regards to what she's doing. Killing the night runners here will not change what her dad is planning, nor make it any safer for any of them. She's here, though, and the knot in her stomach is just as tight as ever. She halts her retreat and goes to a knee near the leading edge of the wing, but on the flat of the fuselage. The curvature of the top is not so bad that she feels fearful of slipping off. Bree unshoulders her M4, ensures a round is chambered, flips the selector switch to semi, turns her night laser and sight on, and brings her carbine to her shoulder.
The night runners below halt their runs against the aircraft and look up at her.
"They've smelled me,"
she thinks, centering her small crosshair on the head of a night runner. The laser, as seen through her NVGs, paints a dot near where her sight is set.
"Aim small, miss small,"
Lynn's words echo in her head. Bree centers her sight right between the night runner's eyes. She is aware that she can't shoot near the aircraft or any of its vitals, so she picks one standing a little distance away. The shrieks and howls escalate, and the night runners renew their efforts against the 130 in an attempt to get to her. She eases the trigger back, feeling a slight kick against her shoulder, sending a round streaking through the night air. A muted cough mixes with the shrieks of the night. The night runner started its charge for her, so the bullet misses where she aimed, but forcefully impacts the night runner high on the forehead. The small 5.56mm round flattens on impact with the thick skull, but punches through, leaving a small entrance hole. The descending angle of the shot alters the bullet's path even more downward and to the right. Bone splinters, and the steel core round plows through the gray tissue. The force of its passage turns the millions of synapses of the brain into jelly. Impacting the skull near the jaw, the enlarged bullet explodes outward in a spray of blood and gray tissue. Meaty chunks and blood splash on the night runner's shoulder and the ground. It falls instantly to its knees, and then forward, impacting the ramp face first. Bree only registers the hit and knows the night runner is taken care of. She watches as another tries to climb the outboard propeller and shifts her aim point. The parallax view allows her to sight in quickly, and, mindful of not hitting the large propeller, she sends another subsonic round into the night. The night runner jerks from the bullet slamming against the side of its head just in front of its ear and is thrown from the prop, hitting the tarmac with a heavy thump. Bree shifts her sights, aligning with another target. Ever conscious of her surroundings, the knot in her stomach, her fear, and her anger all vanish into a business-like function as she is now just shooting at targets.
Greg and I move away from the group and head into the cockpit. I'm guessing he wants to talk about whether we should even be attempting this. I wonder the same thing, but these soldiers, some standing in the rear of the aircraft, have risked themselves for my kids. So why shouldn't the same happen for their families? I would have gone into the high school compound alone for my kids and done anything to get them safely out. I'm sure McCafferty would do the same for hers, and trusts the group to come up with a plan to get them safely out. True, I don't know if they're even in there, but if it were my family, and there was even the remotest of chances they were inside, I would turn the world upside down getting to them.
"Jack, are you sure this is a good idea? I mean, seriously?"
Greg asks once we're alone with only the silent dials and instruments as an audience to our conversation.
"Can you think of another way? I'm seriously open to any and all suggestions," I answer.
"No, I can't. Look, I'm the first to want to help, especially with one of our own team members. But sometimes we have to just chalk it up as a no-go,"
he comments.
"Jack, neither of us is young anymore. Especially you, old man, and it's been a long while since I've done this kind of jump. However, with that said, I'm with you whatever you decide."
"I appreciate that, Greg. Well, I'll accept the old man comment, but I owe these people.